We're starting the ninth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam and the first chapter. And they're all about dynasties. So we'll find out that the purpose of the ninth canto is to lead us up to the tenth canto. And in order to get there, in order for Krishna to appear, there's the dynasties. Krishna didn't appear out of nothing. God doesn't appear out of nothing. He comes from a whole family. So this is the summary of the chapter one. And mostly the ninth canto is, there's probably some purports, but it's mostly stories. So those who like stories, there's plenty of stories in here. Romance, wars, intrigue. Make a good film. So King Sudumna becomes a woman. This chapter describes how Sudumna became a woman, and how, so this is, I think that's quite popular nowadays. What do they call that? What's that? Transvestites? Transgender, yes. So this is from millions of years ago. So we can put this on Facebook that we're actually, we have stories of our, in our line of transgenderites. By the desire of Maharaj Parikshit, Sukadeva Goswami told about the dynasty of Vaivashvata Manu, who was formerly King Satyavrata, the ruler of Dravida. While describing this dynasty, he also described how the Supreme Personality of Godhead, while lying down in the waters of devastation, gave birth to Lord Brahma from a lotus generated from his navel. From the mind of Lord Brahma, Marichi was born, and from his sons was Kasyapa. From Kasyapa through Aditi, Vivashvan was generated. And from Vivashvan came Shraddhadeva, Manu, who was born from the womb of Samgya. Shraddhadeva's wife, Shraddha, gave birth to 10 sons, such as Ikshvaku and Riga. Anyone know who's Ikshvaku? Where he's mentioned? What verse? Braha. Imam Vishvate Yogam Praktivanaham Avyam Vivishan Manave Praha Manor Ishvakave Brevit. So he's in a line of the succession, and who's Nariga? No one ever heard of Nariga? Yes, he was a king. He used to give away more cows than there are stars in the sky. Anyone could tell us how many stars there are in the sky? And he used to give away more cows to the Brahmins than there are drops of rain in a rainstorm. And they weren't ordinary cows. They all had one new calf, so they were all giving milk. And they were covered with a silken wrapper. They had golden horns and silver hooves. And they were all young. He gave them away, but he made one little mistake. One cow that he gave away to one Brahmin entered back into his herd, and then he gave away the same cow again to another Brahmin, and then the one Brahmin who was missing the cow, then he said, why did you take my cow to the other Brahmin? So I didn't take it. The king gave it to me. So then they had an argument whose cow it was. King Nariga heard about the argument and offered 100,000 cows to each one of the Brahmins in exchange for that one cow. And they both refused it. They were so much absorbed in fighting with each other that they didn't even listen to the king. Instead, they gave up the cow and went away angry and cursed the king. So in his next lifetime, he became a lizard. Now, he not only gave away cows, so many unlimited number of cows, hundreds of millions of cows, but he also dug wells and provided places where pilgrims could actually take rest, etc. And he became a lizard. So what's going to happen to us? But he was an ordinary lizard. He actually was, he remembered his past life, and he was always thinking about Krishna. So he was a Mahabhagavat lizard. So therefore, Krishna came and personally took him out of the well with his hand. And he manifested the body of a demigod. He had to go to the heavenly planets in order to enjoy the results of his pious activities, which means he's probably still there. In case you go to the heavenly planets, you could probably meet him. So this is talking about, of course, we won't hear about Nariga until the 10th canto. That was that pastime. But the moral of the story is that don't give anything to a Brahmin and then take it back, even unwillingly, unwittingly. Or even if Krishna tells his sons, even if a Brahmin comes and cuts you with a knife, just smile at him and offer him obeisances. Otherwise, if you don't do that, you're going to have to live as miserably as a worm in stool for 40,000 years, along with your whole family. So Krishna is not so, well, he says it like it is. Sharadeva or Vaivashvata Manu, the father of Maharaj Ikshvaku, was sonless before Ikshvaku's birth. But by the grace of the great sage Vashista, he performed a yajna to satisfy Mritya and Varuna. Then, although Vaivashvata Manu wanted a son, by the desire of his wife, he got a daughter, named Ila. Manu, however, was not satisfied with the daughter. Consequently, for Manu's satisfaction, the great sage Vashista prayed for Ila to be transformed into a boy. And his prayer was fulfilled by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Thus he became a beautiful young man named Sudumya. So we should tell people that if you want to change sex, you should follow Vashista Muni's example and pray to God. And if you're really sincere, he might help you. But there's more to this story. Once upon a time, Sudumya went on a tour with his ministers. At the front foot of the mountain Sumeru, there was a forest named Sukumara. And as soon as they entered the forest, they all were transformed into women. So although he was transformed from a woman to a man, he became a woman again. Imagine his karma. We should take a look at his astrological chart. He must have been born a dual sign, that's for sure. When Maharaj Parikshit inquired from Shukadeva Goswami about the reason for this transformation, Shukadeva Goswami described how Sudumya, being transformed into a woman, accepted Buddha, the son of the moon, as her husband, and had a son named Pururava. Pururava. By the grace of Lord Shiva, Sudumya received the benediction that he might live 1 month as a woman and 1 month as a man. Now, this is a story I think people will really appreciate, especially in America. I mean, it's one thing having a sex change, but if you can do it every month, that's really a kind of like, get the best of both worlds. He even had a child. Imagine, you give birth to, I mean, this is what they want, this is what the modern, some people want. They want a man to give birth to a child, but he actually did it. This is millions of years ago. The month that he was a woman, he gave birth to a child. And the next month, he was its father. What's that? No, this is physical level. I mean, this body is just, it's just our idea that we have this body. The body is, first of all, practically speaking, is all space. 99% of what we're perceiving is just space. But we're not perceiving the space. We're just perceiving the transformation of space into earth, water, fire, air. But it's all just ether, manifestations of ether. So, if you know the right technique, you can do anything because it's just transforming energy. And Krishna has already transformed the energy. Otherwise, how is that you can take water, you can heat it up with fire, and it turns into vapor. And then that vapor can condense, become back water, and turn into ice. So water can become air, like airy, it can become solid. It could become liquidy. And you can heat up water so it'll act just like fire also. You can burn things with hot water. Just ask Ananta. He can show his arm. See? So this idea that, you know, we're men or we're women, obviously there is a transformations of the gross and subtle elements that form into men and women, but they can also be reformed if you have the mystic power to do it. Takes a little glamour away from the whole thing, but anyhow, it's just that's the way things are in the material world. It's 99.99% imagination, and the rest of it is something called real reality. Anyhow, no one came here to find out about the reality. They came here to live in imagination. And it goes on. By the grace of Lord Shiva, Sudumya received the benediction that he would live 1 month as a woman and 1 month as a man. Thus he regained his kingdom and had three sons, Utkala, Gaya, and Vimala, who were all very religious. Thereafter he entrusted the kingdom to Pururava and took the order of Vanaprastha life. So it must have been quite strange for her husband to 1 month you have a wife, and next month you have a brother, or something like that. Anyhow, such is this material world. So now we go on reading the more details. King Parikshit said, "My Lord, Sukadeva Goswami, you have elaborately described all the periods of the various manus, and within those periods, the wonderful activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who has unlimited potency. I am fortunate to have heard all this from you." Now my question is, if anyone could figure it out, if you were a woman 1 month and you were pregnant, then what happens the next month when you become a man? Because it takes 9 months to bear the child. Anyhow, maybe this is... they had a special technique. Satyavrata, the saintly king of Dravida Desha, who received spiritual knowledge at the end of the last millennium by the grace of the Supreme, later became Vaivashvata Manu, the son of Vivashvan. So who's Vivashvan? The sun god. Now the sun god, what is his body made out of? Fire, it's mostly fire. What's that? It's no one has a body. No one in the material world, including Brahma, has a body made out of only one element. Because you couldn't do anything with the body. If your body was only made out of ether, what could you do with it? But it's mostly ethereal, Brahma's body. But there's also earth, water, fire, and air. Otherwise, how could anyone see Brahma? But Vivashvan's body is mostly fire. Otherwise, he couldn't live on the sun planet. But there's also other elements too. Otherwise, how could he give birth to Vaivashvatamanu? And Vaivashvatamanu gives birth to Ikshaku. You know, we're descendants of fire. And indeed, this body is dependent on fire. Although it may not be apparent, but the body actually is manifested from fire. Everyone knows unless there's fire in the stomach, you feel it? Then we can't actually digest anything. And it's by digestive process, not only in the stomach, but fire is throughout the whole body. Otherwise, you can touch your body, and if you're healthy, if you're not dead, then you can feel there's some warmth there. As a matter of fact, after doing exercise, then you certainly feel the body's warmth. So what is that? That's fire. Luckily, generally speaking, it doesn't become so warm that, you know, we just catch on fire. You do a lot of exercise. Oh my God. Put out the fire. But there's fire everywhere. And it's those fires in all the different parts of the body that allow us to see, allow the body to stay warm, allow the transformation, according to the Ayurvedic science, from the food that we eat to lymph, to blood, to muscle, to fat, to asti, which is bone marrow, to bone, and reproductive organs and fluid. It's fire that allows all kinds of transformations to go on. So without fire, we can't live. So Vivashvan, he has a very good fire of digestion, by the way. If you want to have a healthy fire digestion and take birth on the sun planet, because everyone there has a real strong fire digestion. I don't know what they eat there, but it must be quite hot. I guess they don't need so much spice on the sun planet. They probably like things like coconut juice and things that cool you down. At least. Anyhow, we have a very interesting universe. It's much more interesting than this little place that we're living in. And in the next Manvantara period, Manu, I received this knowledge from you. So who's talking? Who received what knowledge from who? I also understand that such kings as Ikshvaku were his sons, as you have already explained. In the next moment, I have received this knowledge from you. I have also understood that such kings as Ikshvaku were his sons, as you have already explained. So this is Pariksha Maharaj talking to Shukadeva Goswami. He's already explained some of this knowledge, but he's going over it again. O greatly fortunate Shukadeva Goswami, O great Brahmana, kindly describe to us separately the dynasties and characteristics of all those kings. You're always eager to hear such topics from you. Well, we'll find a part in this ninth canto. There's a description of the kings, and it goes on for a whole chapter and chapter. So if you're really into... If you're going to give initiation, you can't find some names. You just have to get into the ninth chapter. And there's hundreds of names. Just imagine, and these people are not ordinary people. Some of them had eight mystic powers. Some of them were able to, you know, they killed 100,000 warriors. So many different. And they were, you know, they felt themselves pretty important. And now we're trying to get through their names because it has no meaning whatsoever to us. They made it into the Bhagavatam, you know, by some, because they were in the line of kings. But no one takes them seriously anymore. But when they were present, they were like, oh my God, here he comes. So it's a lesson for us. Even when we get into the Bhagavatam, no one's going to take you seriously. I know I've read the Bhagavatam a number of times, and every time I get to this chapter, they start talking about the king's names, I'm thinking, wow, how many more pages is this? And after 50 years of reading this or more, I still don't remember any of these kings' names. Kindly tell us about the abilities of all these celebrated kings born in the dynasty of King Vivashvata, Manu, including those who have already passed, and those who appear in the future, and those who exist at present. None of these people I recognize. Shukadeva Goswami said, when Shukadeva Goswami, the greatest knower of religious principles, was thus requested by Maharaj Parikshit, in the assembly of all the scholars learned in Vedic knowledge, he then proceeded to speak. So we have to remember this is being spoken 5,000 years ago in India. And some of this will be explaining about dynasties that go up to, I think, at least 1,000 years ago, about 4,000 years. So imagine how much faith the people in India had, especially the Brahmins, when they read these books, and they could actually hear what the future was. That in such and such time this king was going to appear, and he appeared. And therefore people, they took it seriously what the Bhagavatam said, because it could tell you what the history was, what the present was, and it can tell you about the future. And if we take the Bhagavatam seriously, we should get out of here as soon as possible. It's not a very bright future. Unless you want to go through, you know, the end of Kali Yuga, and somehow or another you survive, you hadn't gotten eaten by these little pygmies, or especially they like prasad in the form of devotees. If you can make it through, then you have to go through a devastation. And if you get through that, then you start Satya Yuga again. That's only 427,000 years from now, so just be patient. Other than that, it's going to be hell for the next. The Transcendental Supreme Person, the soul of all living entities. Shukadeva Goswami continued, O kings, the doer of your enemies, now hear from me in great detail about the dynasty of Manu. I shall explain as much as possible, although one could not say everything about it, even in hundreds of years. The Transcendental Supreme Person, the Supersoul of all living entities, who are in different statuses of life, high and low, existed at the end of the millennium, when neither this manifested cosmos nor anything else but him existed. Purport, taking the proper position from which to describe the dynasty of Manu, Shukadeva Goswami begins by saying that when the entire world is inundated, only the Supreme Personality of Godhead exists, and nothing else. Shukadeva Goswami will now describe how the Lord creates other things one after another. So we're starting from the beginning again, after the inundation. We heard about the inundation in the last canto, and everything that happened. Now we're starting again. O King Parikshit, from the navel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead was generated a golden lotus from which the four-faced Lord Brahma took his birth. From the mind of Lord Brahma, Marichi took birth, and from the semen of Marichi, Kashyapa appeared from the womb of the daughter of Daksha. From Kashyapa, by the womb of Aditi, Vivishvan took birth. O King, best of the Bharata dynasty, from Vivashvan, by the womb of Samgya, Shraddhadeva Manu was born. Shraddhadeva Manu, having conquered his senses, begot 10 sons in the womb of his wife, Shraddha. The names of these sons was Ishvaku, Nariga, Saryati, Dishta, Drishta, Kurushaka, Narishanta, Prasradra, Nabaga, and Kavi. So some of these personalities will be described in this, in either this canto or in the 11th canto or in the 10th canto. In fact, some of them, they only get honorable mention here. Manu at first had no sons, therefore in order to get a son for him, the great saint Vishistha, who's very powerful in spiritual knowledge, performed a sacrifice to satisfy the demigod Mritya and Varuna. During that sacrifice, Shraddha, Manu's wife, who was observing the vow of subsisting only by drinking milk, approached the priest, offering the sacrifice, and offered obeisances to him, and begged for a daughter. To see how powerful the priests were. Told by the chief priest, now offer oblations. The person in charge of the oblations took clarified butter to offer. He then remembered the request of Manu's wife and performed the sacrifice while chanting the word Vashat. So take that, note that, Ananta, when you're doing the sacrifice for Nrisimhadeva, if you want to, you can chant the word Vashat. Manu then began that sacrifice for the sake of getting a son, but because the priest was diverted by the request of Manu's wife, a daughter named Ila was born. Upon seeing the daughter, Manu was not very satisfied. Thus he spoke to his guru, Vashistha, as follows. Because Manu had no sons, he was pleased at the birth of the child, even though a daughter, and gave her the name Ila. Later, however, he was not very satisfied to see the daughter instead of a son. Because he had no issue, he was certainly very glad at the birth of Ila, but his pleasure was temporary. And here's the main verse, so I'm going to stop there, otherwise it'll take me too long to read the verse. We'll read that tomorrow. Interesting verse. Any questions or comments? Really hard to comment on this. Yes.
Why is this idea in Vedic culture that the king was dissatisfied with having a daughter? Or maybe you can say something about this.
Well, if you're a king, one of the duties of a king is you're supposed to carry on the dynasty, because the king has the duty of maintaining this, of protecting the citizens. And if there's no descendant, then the citizens remain unprotected. So it's the duty of the king to protect the citizens, including to produce progeny for future kings, so that protection of the citizens can go on. That's the main reason. Just like King Chitraketu, do you know how many wives he had? King Chitraketu? 10 million. And how many could give children? None of them at first. Until he got some benediction from Narada Muni and Angira Muni came, and one of them gave birth to a child. So one was happy, and 9,999,909 women were very unhappy, because all the king's attention, I don't know how he paid attention to his 10 million wives, but somehow or another he was able to do it. But then when only one wife had a child, then he put all his attention on that one child, and everyone else was quite unhappy. Because Chitraketu was able to fulfill his responsibility, producing a child to protect the kingdom, and therefore he was happy. But then, of course, it turned out that the child happened to be in his past life, he was the king's enemy, and he took birth just to cause problems to the king. So in the 9,999,999 wives poisoned the little child, the whole kingdom was very unhappy, including the king and his wife. They were greatly distressed. And the little child that got poisoned and died was very happy because he got revenge on the king. So such, in other words, this will be explained But the idea is, we think, well, here in, you know, the material world, in this little place, wherever we think we are, according to the Bhagavatam, we're in Jambudweep, in Bardvarsha, and only one third of Bardvarsha, by the way. We're not even the whole Bardvarsha. And we think this is it. That we're having a hard time. There's so many wars. There's so, you know, pandemics, whatever. We think we're having a hard time. That if somehow or another there must be a good place. Maybe we can go to America. But no, not America. Maybe, where can you go nowadays? Find some island in the South Pacific somewhere. We think there must be some better place. Let's go to Indraloka. And if you arrive there in time, then you have Vritrasura making his appearance, and he's bigger than, you know, he's like a mountain, and his job is to stamp out the demigods, and you happen to take birth at the wrong time, and you're right underneath his foot. And you're back to Ljubljana again. Short stay in the heavenly planet. Now the idea is that wherever you go in the material world, there's problems. Even Brahma, he's the head of the whole universe. He's the chief demigod. He has an amazing lifetime. 40 billion years. Inconceivable. But he's worried that he's going to die soon. Because we're going to live forever here in Slovenia. But he thinks he's going to die. He only has 40 billion years left. And then he's finished. Even if he takes his vitamins every day. And the whole idea is to discourage us from becoming despondent that we're in the wrong place at the wrong time. If only we were in heaven. If only we had a bigger lifestyle, lifespan. If only I was stronger, faster, wealthier, prettier, handsomer, this and that, then I'd be happy. But no one in this place is happy. And that's what the ninth canto is meant to show us. Give us a little final stroke of renunciation. So when we get into the tenth canto, we can appreciate a little bit more what it's like to be in Krishna in a spiritual pastime, rather than being in Maya in this world of illusions. Even if some of them are more exciting than the ones we have, but after all, they're just temporary and they're all just illusory. So I'll stop there. Are there any other questions? We have one live question here. He'll be back, don't worry.
Hare Krishna. Maybe you already answered it, but anyway, I wanted to ask what is important for us to observe and realize through reading this canto?
Basically speaking, that from the highest planet down to the lowest, there are all places of misery wherein repeated birth and death take place. But one who attains Maya Bodo, son of Kunti, never takes birth again. I mean, we're not in the heavenly planet, so we hear about it. Throughout the other eight cantos, we heard about Indra, mostly about Indra getting into difficulty. He's fighting against Vritrasura, and, you know, practically losing the battle, getting cursed because he molested one sage's wife, Gautama Muni, and he got cursed. Living in a lotus flower for millions of years, etc. So, they've been, throughout the whole eight cantos, they've been trying to discourage us from going to the heavenly planets, trying to get out of the idea that everything is nice there and much better than here, although it is, comparatively, in order to prepare us to actually go back to the spiritual world. We can't go back to the spiritual world if we're a little curious about what's going on in this material world. So it's explaining to us. Not exactly from a positive point of view, but not completely a negative point of view either. There is romance, there's excitement, there's all kinds of things going on in the heavenly planets, but at the end it's just like here. There's not so much difference. It's just a better illusion, that's all. It's like you go to, when I was really young, you know, there was only black and white television. If you could get a channel at all. There was like three channels and one of them never worked. And it was all black and white. And it was all kind of like, you know, the most popular movie was, you know, the TV program was Rin Tin Tin. The same German Shepherd doing the same thing every week. And then there's the Mickey Mouse Club. You know, the same people wearing two big ears all every week. So then they came out with color TV. I remember my uncle had a color TV because he was quite wealthy. So we, on special days, we'd go over his house and he would try to get the color TV to work because you had to adjust the green, the red and the blue to get the thing to work. Or else you look like you had green spacemen on, you know. But it was exciting, you know, color TV. It was a grade up. And now, you know, if you say, would you like to come over to my house? I have a color TV. What? Now, you know, this 3D TV or whatever it is, you know. Probably they'll have smell TV soon. They even have these movie theaters where, you know, some arm comes out and grabs you. So it's there, but it's the same old thing. I mean, why watch television? You can just go outside and you can watch what's going on outside. You don't have to get eye strain. There's also a television that's going on here. So in the same way, we think, well, it'll be an upgrade television program. We go to the heavenly planets, and it is. It's more glam. But after a while, you get used to it. It's like you go to a place like Bali. Every day, it's the perfect weather. So you get used to it. You know, no one talks about the weather in Bali. There's no weather report because it's the same weather every day. So that's not your problem. You find some other problem. And indeed, that's what this talks about. They don't talk about the weather, the ninth canto and the heavenly planets. They talk about all these intrigues between the demigods. You know, how they wind up, even there, they wind up cursing and killing each other. Because they have nothing else to do. It's the nature of the material world. They live a perfect life, but they're bored. So they wind up going through all kinds of intrigues to make life exciting. But we don't have to do that because we have all the excitement right here. But it's not really that much different in the heavenly planets. As I said, you live there for a long enough time, and people do live there. You get used to the whole thing after some time. And even a little discrepancy in the perfection, you get agitated. Someone looks at it the wrong way, there's a whole war between the demigods and the demons. Indra, his spiritual master, Brihaspati, walks into Indra. Indra is being worshipped by all the demigods. He's sitting on his throne, and everyone's glorifying him. Brihaspati just walks in. Indra doesn't immediately pay obeisances and offer him respect. Brihaspati leaves, and Indra he's finished. It's all done. The demons come and attack, and he has to flee. He loses the whole kingdom just because of one little mistake. Could you imagine that? Some sannyasi walks in, and you're reading a book, and you forget, you don't pay obeisances to him, and then you wind up, you know, in Trivialty Park without a home. I mean, it's extreme, isn't it? It would be extreme. But that's the heavenly planners are like that. You can be either completely on the top one moment or completely on the bottom. Anything else?
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna, there is a question from Avadhuta Rai Prabhu. Ramachandra Khan, who offended Haridas Thakur, asked for forgiveness for his offense, but I read the Supreme Lord still did not forgive the offense so Ramachandra Khan had to suffer. Question. Why the Lord did not forgive also the offense, like in the case of Durvasa and Ambarisha story?
Well, Ramachandra Khan was the one who defamed, who tried to, he sent a prostitute to Haridas Thakur. And then he, there is no story about his asking for, he's thinking of Gopala Chapala. Gopala Chapala, he tried to defame Srivas Thakur and put the paraphernalia for worshipping Durgadev in front of his doorstep at night. And the next morning, Srivas Thakur woke up to find all the paraphernalia for worshipping Durga. And he called all the respectable gentlemen from the neighborhood and said, see, secretly at night I'm worshipping Durga. And so the men called for the Hathi who come and sweep it up, because they realized that some sinful rascal was trying to defame Srivas Thakur. So that rascal was Gopala Chapala, who contacted leprosy and had to go outside the village, because leprosy is supposed to be contagious. And while he was there, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was passing by, and Gopala Chapala asked Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, my dear brother, please, you're the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You come here to save all the suffering souls. I'm suffering. Please save me. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, because you've defamed Srivas Thakur, not only I'm not going to save you, but I curse you. You're going to have to remain like this for millions of years. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went on his journey. He came back, and Gopala Chapala asked Chaitanya Mahaprabhu again, please help me. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, you have to go and ask for forgiveness from Srivas Thakur, and if you do that, then the Lord will save you. So he did that, and he was saved. So that's the story. Otherwise, Ramachandra Khan, he tried to defame Haridas Thakur, and Lord Nityananda, he came with his coward boyfriends to the house of Ramachandra Khan, because in the house at that time, the outside was called the Durga Mandapa, where Durga was worshipped, and the inside of the house is where the ladies were living. So Ramachandra Khan was with his daughters and wife, and Lord Nityananda was on the outside. So the servants came and said, Lord Nityananda has come with his followers, what should we do? So he told Ramachandra Khan, said that this place is not worthy of Lord Nityananda. He should go and find a cowherd shed to live in. So Lord Nityananda became angry and said, yes, this place is not worthy of a meat-eating Brahmin, meat-eater, cow-eater. So he got angry and he left. You don't want to make Lord Nityananda angry. And so Lord Ramachandra Khan was so envious of Lord Nityananda, he had his servant go and dig up the earth wherever Lord Nityananda's lotus feet had touched, or his followers had touched, dig up the earth and throw it outside his house. I mean, that's envious. And because of that, because of his sinful activities, therefore his fellow tax collector, who was a Muslim, came and eventually arrested him for stealing the taxes and keeping them for himself, arrested his family, and plundered the whole town. And arrested everyone. So that's the story. He didn't get forgiveness because he never asked for it. But he did get the reaction. Okay, thank you very much. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.